Mobile home parks are a really special asset class within real estate for this one reason. They're kind of a walled garden. So basically, you know, the concept is that, oh, you just, you know, you could buy a bad house, but it has to be in a good neighborhood. And with a mobile home park, you can actually improve the neighborhoods. You kind of break the rule of real estate, location, location, location a little bit. Not to the fullest, but it's gray. It can shift a little bit.
Welcome to the Millionaire Journey podcast. I'm your host, Glenn Yaney. The goal of this podcast is to guide and empower you on your journey towards financial independence. And today I have Damian Bergamaschke, and I have met him on Twitter, and I've read a little bit about him, but we have a Brett Burris we interviewed probably about like a month ago, but we'll have his podcast come out first, and then Damian's will come up next. So I guess, Damian, if you could just tell us a little bit about yourself.
Yeah, well, first off, Brett's going to be a tough act to follow because he's pretty good. That's he's very good at that. But I guess I would say me. I mean, we could start at the beginning. We could start in the middle. We could start with what I'm doing now. But at the end of the day, I'm a professional real estate investor. I started an investment firm called Damaris Capital about 10 or 15 years ago. Managed all my own private money. Then it went to friends and family. Then we spread out to doing real estate syndications through funds of funds like LP of LPs. Then that led to doing actual direct operator ownership of specifically mobile home parks. That's kind of what we're doing now. I mean, you want me to like kind of go back from the beginning?
Well, really, the first thought would be for me is how did you get started in having people trust you to give you money?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think the answer started as I trusted myself first. Everything that I did first was with my own money. And there's like it's in my signature line. It's called like fully invested. That's how I sign everything. And it's like I guess it sort of became like a core value, my company and just in my life. Actually, Brett even told me that there's even like a biblical reference to that, which I didn't even realize. But but basically I put everything that I had into all the things that I was doing first, like to the point where any return that I got was more meaningful for the return on my own capital than the capital of anybody else that was going to invest. And then just over time, you know, meeting commitments and showing up every day, people start to trust you. And then those people refer people that trust you. And then before you know it, you actually know what you're talking about. You don't sound like a jackass anymore. And then before you know it, you're almost 40, which you don't have that little kid thing to worry about anymore. And it just kind of takes off from there, you know? So I would say you got to eat your own dog food. That's the answer.
The one thing that is probably overlooked frequently, and I know it happens with me, and I haven't been doing it as long as you, but it seems like when people talk to you, I'm sure it comes up that you're an overnight success and 15-year overnight success, you know?
Yeah, well, you know, the thing is, like, I still feel like I got so much more to do. Yeah. I feel like I'm somewhere, you know, in the middle of my journey. Like, if I put it on, like, you know, with the podcast.
Yeah.
You know, and the other thing, too, that I've learned is that the goalpost, like, kind of moves a little bit. I mean, I grew up, you know, middle-class family, Long Island, New York. My mom was, you know, an immigrant from Italy. She came here when she was like 20. She actually has like a full degree in teaching, but she was a teacher's aide because, you know, she came over here. She was a bus matron. My dad was a musician, jack of all trades. So I kind of grew up in, I would say, a very stable, you know, I was blessed to have like that kind of stable middle-class home. But there was always this concept of like leanness and like scarcity that just because there was, my parents didn't have those white collar, you know, kind of professions. And that kind of instilled like a get to work early kind of, I guess, like culture for me. Like I started working very early. And I remember one of the first jobs that I got was at a comic book store. I didn't even like comic books per se, but my cousin had started working there. And he basically got me that job. And I remember I was working there and I think I was making like $4 an hour or something like that. This is like, you know, ancient history now. But I remember I worked there for like an hour and a half, like each day after school. So I get like $6. And because we didn't go out to eat a lot at home, like there was a Chinese food restaurant place like right next door. And I remember working the whole time, getting the $6 and then going and spending like $5.38 on like a Chinese food meal. It was like this like vice for me. And at that moment, I actually had this realization, which is kind of funny. I think I was maybe 12 or 13 years old. I was like, wow, I don't know if that was worth the time, you know, after I was done with it. And then I had this other experience, I think about like a year later, where my mom asked me, hey, could you clean out the basement? And I remember there was like a stack of books on the couch and there was just stuff everywhere. And I looked, you know, every book has got the price tag on it. It says like US this much, Canada this much. And the book said something like $10, which to me was at the time, was like, that's a lot of money. And book's not the worst investment, depending on the book, but there was like a whole stack. And I was like, wow, this is like $100 of stuff. And then I kind of zoomed out and looked at the whole basement. I was like, there's probably like $50,000 worth of stuff that we don't look at or use. And that kind of led to like, wow, time is money, the whole Chinese food story. And then we waste a hell of a lot of it. And that kind of triggered like a thing in me right as I was going into high school where I kind of was like, I discovered the compounding experience. I would actually do like compound interest formulas in my notebooks. That was my doodle in high school. And there was this thing that I wanted to very much not to feel like there was all this pressure all the time. And then when I went to college, I got a degree in finance and I was a student athlete. I swam in college and I actually did triathlon for quite a few years. I actually had my pro card for a few years and I got really disciplined into that. But when I was in college, things got even leaner. Is my dad was a musician and he was doing pretty good in the heydays when there was like bands and, you know, for weddings and things like that. But then the DJ came along and then that completely wrecked that industry. And for, you know, a band leader, when the DJ came, it was like your coal mine running out of coal in your coal town, you know? So that put even more pressure on that. And I got like almost insular and I just started studying the stock market. I just would look at charts all the time. I read more at Barnes and Noble's sitting at the store for free while I was in college than I think I studied at college, to be honest with you. I read like every book in that finance section. And I found sort of like kind of niche within investing, which is called like the volatility index, the VIX. I don't know if you guys, if you've ever heard of it.
Yeah.
But I kind of saw that it was like mean reverting and it kind of had an upper and a lower bound. And I was like, there might be something to understanding this. And it was having an inverse relationship to the stock market. And I had started kind of learning about derivatives and options and it was trading options, mostly like selling, you know, credit spreads and things like that. And I found this little pattern that I like pulled all the data back into Excel. And I actually went back 20 years. I had to create some synthetic data to kind of prove some of this stuff out. And I found a pattern in there. And then I met my partner in Damaris, Chris, who was had a coding background. So I used my data chops and he used his coding background and we actually coded this system. Now that's actually like 15 years ago. It's even that predates Damaris. And we followed it for a year with no money in it. And then we were like, man, we probably should have done that because that worked. Then we put our own money into it for like a year. Not a lot. We put like $10,000 each into it. And that worked. And we're not talking like, you know, like we're making 1,000% return a year, but it was following. And we knew over the long haul, this could compound at like 20 or 30 or 40% in the bigger picture, though it was volatile. So fast forward, we still do that strategy today. Last year was a phenomenal year for the strategy. Actually, we broke, I think it was like 87% return last year on that one strategy. And I don't put all my money into that. I have about another one that we've created, which is like a core holding, which is much more conservative. And they kind of actually balance each other out. And I would say about, it's probably about 7 or 8 years ago when we created Damaris to actually, you know, as an entity, as a registered investment advisory, we traded our own money. Then I did, you know, my family, some friends, and then went to like colleagues that I had worked with. And then it kind of stretched out from there. After doing that for, I would say about 5 or 6 years ago, I was married at that point. My wife and I were saving like crazy. We were in a small 500 square foot studio. I mean, not studio, one bedroom apartment. And I think we were saving at our best year. I think we saved like 80% of our take home. And we were putting every dollar into like fully invested into investments. And then I kind of had this realization that I was loading like 401ks, Roths, SEPs, traditional IRAs. It was all like the stuff that you can take out until, you know, you're basically like ready to retire. And I said that, you know, I don't know if it makes sense for us to just be really, really wealthy 35 years from now, you know? So our strategy, it didn't make sense to put it in a taxable account because there's a way that it managed risk. It kind of had to do some trading. So we started to look into like real estate, and I was kind of flying all over the country trying to figure out which market I wanted to be in. And I thought I was going to do, you know, maybe a multifamily, like a duplex or something like that. And then I stumbled across a private equity, somebody who I knew had a private equity relationship where they invested in a mobile home park. And when I saw that P&L, it was so different than any other deal that I had seen that it kind of captured my attention. And then as I learned more and more about it, I realized it was a really good space to be in. And then that triggered the next phase, which was Damaris, which was I decided that I didn't have enough experience at the moment to go out and buy out of state, try to manage a difficult asset to manage because I didn't have the experience. So I found a network of operators that had a track record that focused on mobile home parks. And I raised money mostly from my own funds. Like I put about, I think it was like $400,000 or $450,000 of my own money into that fund. The rest was basically like people had my last name like, and my partner's last name. And we went into that with a little bit over $1 million. And we made allocations into these other GPs, and we were an LP. And basically that allowed us to kind of diversify by state, by park, number of doors, operator style. Some were value add, some were more stabilized. And that went pretty well. And then I would say about a year or a year and a half later, we did Freedom Fund 2, which was to go out to other investors. I actually had done a bunch of podcasts. We raised some money online, more friends and family. And that one we raised a few million dollars. And basically the whole thing was that we were pooling and co-investing to get better terms, because instead of writing a $50,000 check, we were going to write $250,000 or $500,000. And we kind of negotiated SLAs, side letter agreements on, you know, higher prefs, bigger payouts, you know, moving up in the capital stack, things like that. And what I learned through that whole experience was that as an LP, some of the GPs we were investing in were phenomenal, and some of them disappointed us. And there was like a consistent pattern of the simple thing I would say is like, if you don't get your K-1 on time, you're probably also not doing, you know, some of the other things you should be doing in your property on time. And that got me thinking a lot about, I liked being in control and being able to be directly responsible. I think it was the right way for us to start. And it gave us also a lot of experience. You know, we were looking at P&Ls and quarterly reports from parks all over the country. And I found that there was a kind of a niche within the niche of mobile home parks. And it was smaller parks that basically they had a higher yield up front. And there was a lot of park-owned homes in them. But there was an ability to sell those homes and had infill and value add that the bigger stabilized parks didn't have. And I was like, I can find those. So I ended up going out and doing the same move. I bought a park by myself with my own money that was in South Carolina, which where I was moving to, which is where I'm at now. And I started directly operating that one. I've had that for about 3 years now. When we bought it, it was a 21 unit park. I think now we're going to get zoned for 22 because there's a little space. It's not there yet. And I think we had about 7 or 8 tenants paying at the moment. Everything else is vacant. And now I think all units are full with the exception of 2, which we're working on. So the cash flow on that's improved tremendously. We got it right during the fear of the COVID kind of scenario. And yeah, so that told me, I was like, yep, we want to be an operator.
Yeah. So with the first park, did you sell off all the units? Did you make them all tenant owned homes?
So that was the plan initially out of the gate.
Yeah.
And it's still the plan today. I've only sold one of the homes there, and there's a reason for it. I ended up working with a guy that we found in that area. He's actually the son of the person we bought it from, and he's phenomenal. We basically said like, hey, you're not just doing this park. You're going to come with us and do other parks. But having only one park, we needed the revenue intensity
to
support him and not, you know, because if I sold them all off, I'd be like, well, what am I going to do with Steven? And I felt like Steven was almost as valuable as the park because, you know, the trust and the relationship that we had that was like we could do other things. So we sold off the stuff that we didn't want and we actually had it moved out. And right now we're working more on RTOs because now we've scaled up with Brett's help to go find basically other properties in that area. We've bought other parks that we can kind of treat this more like a portfolio company instead of just a property. So now we're doing like rent to owns agreements, which we've tested out in the other parks, and it's going to happen at that one. The other thing too is I think there's a right time to do that in a park and a wrong time. I think it's the wrong time when you buy a distressed asset or something that is really early in the value add phase and start selling it because you lose the ability to kind of shape a neighborhood. Because when you own the home, you have more ability to be like, you're not following rules. Like you shouldn't be here. There's a longer vetting period. So even on our RTOs, the way we're doing it, we won't sell it. We won't, even if you show up with cash, I will not sell you a home. And you have to first live in that park for 6 to 12 months. Make sure you follow all the rules, no violations, regular inspection of the home to make sure you're taking care of our asset before it's your asset. And then if you prove all those things, then we'll sell you the home. You can exercise that option.
Yeah, definitely. I had the same experience myself with buying them. We had full intention to sell them. And the second you realize, it's like most of our parks when we first bought them were like the lot rents were like $500, $600 a month. And we were able to get like $1,200 to $1,300. And it's one of those things where you're like, do I really want to sell this off? And then also stabilizing it, trying to get the best resident in you can. And when the park is brand new, it's not exactly the type of park that a normal resident would want to move into or come up with a lot of cash to buy it. You know, once you get it to a nicer level of park, then you could sell the homes for almost probably twice the amount that you would have sold it on the front end.
Yeah, 100%. And I think a lot, I think mostly it's about, I say this all the time, mobile home parks are a really special asset class within real estate. For this one reason, they're kind of a walled garden, right? So basically, you know, the concept is that, oh, you just, you know, you could buy a bad house, but it has to be in a good neighborhood. And with a mobile home park, you can actually improve the neighborhood. So you kind of break the rule of real estate, location, location, location a little bit. Not to the fullest, but it's gray. It can shift a little bit. Like you can't buy a multifamily apartment building in a bad neighborhood and expect to change that neighborhood, but you can buy a weak, you know, or class D mobile home park, fix the entire things within your perimeter, and it go up a few star ratings. Like I've seen it happen. We've executed on that. And it's not something you can see in months. It's something you could see in years, but it's pretty neat. I mean, if you think about every wealthy neighborhood in this country, you cross a street, you cross the tracks, and the neighborhood changes. You know, I know it's like that all over the place in Long Island. It's sort of like that over here where I live now. So there's these psychological barriers that you could be like, nice, not nice. And I like to think that the fence around my park is that barrier and I get to control that. And doing the park on home first and then slowly executing to the RTO, I think is the best way to increase the odds that that goes smoothly.
Yeah, definitely. And the other thing is that, you know, changing the whole stigma of the park as well. I was actually dealing with a code enforcement guy yesterday and he was talking as if like mobile home parks aren't going to be around. And I'm like, this is a place where literally it's affordable housing and these people need places to live. And what they were telling me to do, this is something that just drove me nuts. But they were saying, this guy, we did like a rent to own, and then we were trying to evict the resident on the rent to own. But while we're under eviction, he called code enforcement on the unit. And it was something that had to do with the heater. And they're not allowed to have window units as heaters. So they wanted us to install a full central AC unit on the place, which would be probably like $8,000. And I was just like, so this trailer that we're pretty much are selling for between $10,000 and $15,000, you're going to tell us that we need to install an $8,000 AC unit on it, you know?
It's crazy. I realized this the first year that I was in. I actually, every time summer comes, like the first park that I have is in South Carolina. So yeah. Whenever the summer comes, like I don't call it summer, I call it HVAC season.
Yeah.
But I realized that, wow, my first car, it reminded me of that. My first car was a 1995 Oldsmobile Cutlass Supreme. And the value of that car would fluctuate based off of how much gas was in the tank. And it reminded me that with these homes, that the value of these homes depends on how old the HVAC system is. You know, it's really like a lot of times it's an HVAC system with a roof, you know?
Yep.
So that's a crazy phenomenon in this space. But, and I don't think people outside of it really appreciate it the way you just described.
Yeah. And really, you know, we actually have four parks under contract right now, but three of them are, we'll say two of them are in rough shape. And like, it's either the park gets scraped and turned into a couple single family home houses for a lot of money or whatever, or you could clean the park up and make it back to what it used to be. And that's kind of what our approach is. And it sounds similar. And, you know, this one property is got, we could probably bring in 10 dumpsters full, like 20 yard dumpsters, and fill it up right now just from all the trash that's in the park.
Yeah.
And you're like, how did they get to this point? And but anyways, we're going to clean it up, but it's going to be a nice place to live is what I would like to think. And some people won't like it as you're doing it. You know, some residents are going to be resistant to it. And yeah, that's part of the job, you know?
Yeah. There's like the fat middle that's just silent when you go into a park and start doing stuff. And then there's this extreme and that extreme of the barbell. Some people just are over the moon that somebody cares and they see it. And then there's other people that just don't want anything to change at all.
Yeah.
With it, unreasonable, you know?
So I guess to kind of pedal back a little bit, so you went from a limited partner to general partner. So I guess just tell us a little bit about the portfolio that you own as a GP status, where you're operating and managing them. I think Brett was saying that you guys have a third party company that helps manage the operations.
Yep. So we use third party managers, and then also we'll hire on-site guys at parks, basically to do boots on the ground and kind of essentially help the third party management. It also helps keep the costs down a little bit, especially when you're buying a value add park. There's always so much work to do. We have enough work at all times to keep somebody busy. So it doesn't make sense to kind of have a third party manager keep like hitting you with a million tickets and subcontractors on things. You know, we use licensed trades when we have to, but for everything else, you know, we just keep our guys on staff. And recently, we've been really scaling up our operation for infill, and we're trying to get to four concurrent crews working at a time, fixing up homes, just because we're trying to be very regional in our acquisition so we can kind of use the same relationships. So like right now, I would say our biggest focus is in Michigan, in this Flint area. You know, we got our first deal with Brett and this Counter Capital Holdings. That's the GP entity that manages that. And then we got another park down the block, and we're in negotiations and kind of on the 1 yard line with about three or four other parks that are right in that area. So I think we're gonna have a very big presence there. It's always interesting when you say Flint and people are like, oh yeah, I know that town. You know, the water's good now.
Yeah. So the I completely lost my train of thought. Oh, so infilling.
Yeah.
So if you could kind of break down a little bit about that, because that is something that we're somewhat new to. We do fill in some spots, but if you could just, I guess, give a little bit of the financial of how that works. You buy them used or new or?
Yeah. So the parks, there's a great way to do this where you get them new. You know, there's like that Clayton Cash program, but you have to have the right asset for that. You know, we're in value add assets. And the first thing I would say is you got to understand, like when you look at a park, the most important thing first is what's the layout? What's the lot size layout? I think that might be the most important thing, like before anything else, because it kind of dictates the whole, you got to think about your homes or your product, and you have to think about how big are your shelves. So what product can I put there? And a lot of the parks that we do that meet our buy box, which is have very high yield on the way in, we're trying to pay as little or no premium for value add in the future. And they have an ability to get kind of repriced. In other words, some cap rate compression. Those assets tend to have at least some of the lots be on the smaller side, that they'll be difficult to fill new inventory. So it's hard to go to like Clayton and be like, hey, I'll just be a dealership for you guys and start selling your homes. And that's great because it's very low capital on you as the park owner. You just turn into a sales entity, you know?
Yeah.
So what we have to do, and I think even in any park, there's some level of finding used inventory is just a great idea. It helps speed things up too. But yeah, we go out and find used homes. That's a lot of what Brett does. Brett, if you listen to his podcast episode, he's wholesaled and done direct to seller marketing for hundreds of transactions, like on the single family side. And he's taken all that experience and pouring it into basically finding infill homes for us in our areas. So we'll go find leads on that. We're working a lot in parks that we are actually interested in buying, and it helps us build relationships with those park owners as well. So this kind of like a secondary approach. It's a great way to kind of get your foot in the door and toss around if there's interest. And most of the time when a park owner has a lot of homes that they are willing to have you rehab or sell, it's because they're struggling. They don't know how to do it. So we'll try to find basically, you know, when a home matches an inventory need that we have, we'll get it. We try to focus on things that be under a month to rehab. I would say materials cost wise, we're trying to keep it under $5,000 if possible, and trying to get the home for almost as close to the moving cost as possible.
Yeah.
Sometimes you got to put a little bit in there, or if it has a little bit more potential, you can actually pay something for the home. But it depends on the market. You know, in Flint, you can kind of do that. In South Carolina, like even the worst home has a high premium because there's a lot more demand there. I kind of feel like real estate is in this weird spot right now where, like, if you just kind of look at the Sun Belt has a ton of supply, believe it or not, in new construction and single family houses coming online, but there's a ton of demand. And because of that, you know, it has great demographics and all that kind of stuff. Like up in the like Detroit in that area, believe it or not, Detroit in the past 12 months has been the best appreciation market in the country.
Wow.
Wild,
it came
right?
From the bottom, you know, it's like dirt prices all day, or cheaper than dirt, I guess.
Yeah, but they've been at the bottom for a long time. And it's right? So what's happening now is that we're seeing is that there's spots where, yeah, there may not be a lot of demand, but its supply is so low in those areas because nobody wanted to invest there at all, that like the north, like even in New York and things like that, nobody was building up there. So there's not a lot of supply there. So there's different things you can do in different markets. But if you're in like a boom market, you're going to have to pay for homes and fix them, and you'll sell them because there's an ever, you know, flow of people to come buy them. But up north in those markets, you can get the homes for free in a lot of cases, or pay very little, just, you know, have to move them, but you got to market them. There's an endless line of people moving there.
Yeah, we're still kind of learning the process of selling them. So say if you were to find a home for sale, do you find them in other mobile home parks? Then you'd pull them out?
Yeah, so in like the Flint area, it's a lot in other mobile home parks. In, let's say, like my area here, like I'm just south of Charlotte. The phenomena that's happening here is, like, I have a bunch of realtors too that they'll call me and say, hey, I'm selling this house, this piece of land. There's an old mobile home on it, and we're trying to build $1 million house on it. You know, can you help with this? So it's a different kind of dynamic, and that happens here. And, you know, you have to do kind of far moving costs for it, but your inventory is generally really good because that was a true pride of ownership home. They tend to be bigger. You get a lot of double wides that way. You can kind of source. So every market is very specific and regional, like for this type of infill. But I think there's a massive opportunity for infill parks. The supply chain issues of COVID tripped up. I mean, I saw it like in the portfolio that we were invested in as an LP, the parks that relied on infill to execute their strategy struggled because you couldn't get anything. And the used homes were too expensive where it didn't pencil the way it did before. So a lot of operators stumbled over the past few years. And I think it created an even bigger infill problem, AKA opportunity to go in and fix. I think another thing that happened with that too is like, I think just the nature of what happened with inflation for the past few years has created a lot of opportunity now. And I think the single biggest reason is that park owners, especially mom and pops, are not disciplined typically about raising rent.
Mm-hmm.
Like they don't have like a clock that says, oh, it just renewed, like, let's do it. You know, I think it's the biggest value add in real estate. People say it's paint. I think it's remembering to raise rent so you're at market. So the dislocation between market rent and actual rent because of inflation, I don't think has ever been higher since I've seen it. I mean, I haven't been in this game for 50 years, but it's definitely a lot higher now than it was 5, 6, 7 years ago from what I can see. And then the other thing that happened is that when inflation went up, lenders get hosed and they get scared. So they stopped lending and all of these parks that were marginal to get money for became impossible to get money for. Mm-hmm. And what happened there is that now you're negotiating again with people as opposed to like conceding if you wanted to buy. And they're open to seller financing, which I think you can get a better discount on terms than you can on the park. And I think that's the big opportunity right now is we're seeing parks where people got way behind. I think you have to be an amazing operator. Like you have to go after operational excellence as an operator to create value with these because otherwise it's a value trap. But if you can produce and actually fix homes, find homes, rent homes, sell homes, like the, you know, the dirty things, then they actually are a value to you. And I feel like the competition is not the same set in that space because of access to capital and because it's hard.
Yep. I'm in a mastermind group. And I've noticed that most of these capital raisers are all raising, like, it's like $100 million fund. It's like, okay, well, you know, with generally you can buy a mobile home park. We'll just say like a normal size mobile home park, like say 20 to 50 unit with between $1 to $2 million, you know? So it's, and it makes it a lot easier. And, you know, a lot of people, you know, even the bigger investor guys, they like to see that they have a bigger percentage of ownership. So if they're buying into $100 million fund, they're just like, what's my $200,000, $500,000 investment going to do? And you have these guys that, you know, they want to see that they have 10 to 20% of the deal. And it helps as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I guess we've talked about it a little bit, but so what's next? What's the next goal for you and where are you heading?
Yeah. So I would say the biggest thing, I had a little bit of like a pause for the past 2 years, like on my rental business, other than operating, because I wanted to relocate my young family. Married, I got a beautiful, amazing wife and two young boys. They're 2 years and 5 years old. And we wanted to get out of New York City and come, you know, kind of move out. So first we stopped in New Jersey for 2 or 3 years. And then we sold that place and we embarked on this adventure, which I'm in right now. We actually bought a 50-acre unparceled lot of land, 30 minutes outside of Charlotte. It's all agricultural timberland. And we built a road. I did the entitlement for all the utilities. I brought every utility in, natural gas, electric, fiber, put in water taps, wells, septic, all that kind of stuff. And I did a lot of it myself. I GC'd it and then did a lot of it myself, which was an amazing learning experience for the mobile home park space because a lot of it's infrastructure and easements. And you really learn how to do stuff when you do it. So that was a big part of it. I somehow herded the cats and got my family to move down. And right out that window, we're building my father-in-law's house. And down the road, about a half a mile, we're building my parents' house. And we're actually got maybe a brother-in-law or a sister that may also come here. So we got a little bit of a family compound project. And that's been taking a lot of our time and energy for the past few years. We're actually in phase one. We built like a garage guest house first, which I'm in. And we're going to start building my actual main house right next door and kind of connect them. So I think the next few years is all about building that house and building the rental portfolio and just kind of leaning into it. So I do nice and weekends is building. I do a lot of like trim and carpentry, you know, built our whole kitchen from scratch. And so I'm doing that on the weekends. And then my day job is trying to do the same thing on a different level with mobile homes.
So any plans of development?
It's so funny that you say that, man. I don't think I would do something new from scratch because every time I looked at it, it just doesn't pencil the right way. But it's sad, actually. It actually disappoints me a little bit because I would love to create something from a like a starting vision. It just doesn't seem to work out. But I'm very partial to a park that has existing cash flow where we can kind of do it organically. And, you know, maybe there's like a park, like there was one that we lost, but it may come back to us. We'll see. That had like 20 units that were cash flowing and it was priced right and zoned for 20 more units. And they were all the right size lots. Like you could actually done new inventory. And I think I would do something like that and, you know, kind of use cash flow from the property to put like a line in and then sell a few of them and then use the money from that to build the next line and yada, yada. But I don't think from scratch, like it makes sense. I would develop like a single family home subdivision before I built a new mobile home park. Like,
yeah, exactly. Yeah. When I see something like that, I have a friend that just bought a 60 unit that had a 60 unit attached to it, already zoned. And he's like a one man operator, doesn't raise money. So the risk is his own money. This is, and I see like a deal like that. It has to be like full disclosure. Look, we're going into uncharted territory and there's a lot of upside we see. It's just that, you know, trying to figure out the development arm long term will get paid out. But
yeah, I agree with you, man. Like the way I try to think about it is like everything costs more than you think. Everything's going to take longer than you think it's going to take, like every time. And that's okay because we're in a business where time is your friend, but you have to own an asset where time is your friend.
Yes.
You know, so that deal can work if you're like, you know what? I'm not going to do it. Like, let's give up on that dream. And it's still, you know, you bought it at like a 12 or 13 or 14 cap. And, you know, after it's stabilized for a few years, it's, you know, a 15 or a 16 or a 17 or an 18, you know, from your entry. That's fine. Maybe it changes in the future. Maybe you do develop it. Maybe you don't. But I think it's very risky if you buy it where that has to happen. And it has to happen in a certain time frame. And it has to happen for a certain budget for it to make sense. That's dangerous.
Yeah. So I think it's AJ Osborne that said it, that stuck with me. He said, I have a 2-year-old in the back now. Man.
Mine's upstairs right now. I told my wife, I said, hey, keep that monster up there for a little bit.
Yeah. There's one home for sick today. So it's added an extra level of volume.
Nice.
Yeah. Good. So the AJ Osborne says this one thing and it stuck with me. It says, there's two things that fail is the deal and then there's deal structure. Those are the two things that fail in real estate. And if you structure a deal incorrectly, it doesn't matter how good the deal is, that the structure will make the deal fail. Kind of like 2008, you know, that those are bad deal structures. And then a lot of them were balloons, you know, people couldn't pay them off, get out from underneath them. And then with the deal, you know, you just have to pay the right price. And you could pay the right price, but if you don't structure it correctly, you could pretty much take all the value out of the deal just through debt payments, investor payments, and stuff like that. So
it's really interesting because I'm obsessive when it comes to like this one topic internally. I'm like, you will not lose in this game as long as you always remain in control of the asset. If you put yourself in a position where you can lose control of the asset, that's how you lose. There's like that Charlie Munger invert thing. Have you ever heard of that? Where basically the premise is that we're really good as like humans because of our fear and flight and paranoia or whatever it is that we have to stay alive at figuring out every problem that could possibly happen. Like we've all talked to I'll be at family parties and everybody will be talking about why you can't own and rent real estate. And I'll just be there quiet, just listening. I'm like, you can't do it. You can't do it. So, but basically the story there is that every single person is like, we're really good at that. So we started doing this exercise after I learned about this was, let's think of all the ways we could lose money on this deal. And then you just try to like invert, like you have your list of problems and they're like, invert it. And the top one is always like, well, this deal structure has a gun to the head this way. And if we don't execute at a B+ or better, and if this comes up, like that's it. That's how it would happen. So you always need more runway than you think. And there's another one that I learned. It's very interesting. I take a lot of what I learned in like the paper equity stock market type of experience, which by the way, those people don't typically talk to the real estate people. Like they're not the same. So I feel like I'm a weird bird like that. But one of the sayings that I picked up from there is that your worst drawdown is always ahead of you. So if you look at a historical, you know, 200-year chart and be like, well, you know, the worst drawdown was 29% or it was 57%. I guarantee you, you do something long enough, the worst drawdown is always ahead of you. So you have to kind of think about it to real estate too, is that the thing that's never happened to you at any other park, like, is going to happen to you at some point at any park if you own it long enough. So it's kind of changed my risk appetite a lot. I probably would have been like way more into like higher LTVs a few years ago. And I just don't think it's worth it now, you know?
Yeah. The kids are abrupting up there. So
yeah, it's all good, man.
Yeah. But it was great having you on the show. And I guess we'll have all your contact information. Damien's pretty active on Twitter from what I've seen. Are you on any other platforms or?
No, that's just, we kind of made a decision. I was like, you know, I think we're going to do this, document the Twitter journey a little bit. Like, so mostly on there. You can check us out on our website. This is countercapitalholdings.com. My other business is Damrus Capital, which is, you know, damruscapital.com, which has got the investment in the all the algorithmic trading and the other, you know, syndications that we did as LPs. And just reach out to me.
Great. Well, thanks for being on the show. And we'll talk a little bit after. I guess have a good day.
Yeah, you too, man. Take it easy, Glenn.
Thank you for listening to the Millionaire Journey podcast. Please rate, like, subscribe, leave a comment, and share with somebody you'd think would benefit from listening. Till then, see you next week.